Good evening, everybody. I'm John, an alcoholic. Nice to be here. Nice to be asked to come here, actually. There was a time that that wasn't so. I dig the venue. And I hate to get in front of myself, but I got to. When COVID hit, we were over, my home group at that time was Pattonburg, Wednesday night in Jersey. And when COVID hit that St. Patrick's Day, we went outside. And we stayed outside for the next 3 years. And it was kind of cool because we were Wednesday open speaker, and then we started another meeting on a Friday. And the place was really electrifying. It was really neat. Because we had a lot of people from Lehigh Valley coming, people from Flemington, people from Summit, people from Perth Amboy, and it was a good mix of people that really energized us. It really did. We sort of missed it. What had happened was the church went out, basically went out, and they sold it, and we lost the place. Now we're in Clinton, Friday night, 7 o'clock. So, you know, it's funny because our group is an open speaker meeting in Jersey, and if you know what that is, we typically like to go out with three or four or five people on a commitment, and everybody takes 10 or 15 minutes, and I'm like, this is a little different. Not that I couldn't do it, but, you know, it's funny because all these years of doing what I just told you, now it's like a shift, you know. So I guess I'm going to talk about stuff that I normally wouldn't, just didn't have the time. So I grew up in Perth Amboy. If you don't know where that is, that's as far east as you can get in Jersey. Staten Island and Perth Amboy are connected via the Outer Bridge, and I'll get back to that later. So, you know, growing up, my mom was a really nasty, violent person, alcoholic. And that's not why I drank, but, you know, as a little kid growing up in a crazy home, always trying to figure out what's going on, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop. I had two older sisters and a younger brother. And, you know, I don't know how I became my mom's drinking buddy. And, you know, wherever she went, a lot of Newark stuff. Somehow, you know, she was into the Irish pubs, and Newark and Kearney and Harrison and all up that way in Jersey was where her and all her lady friends drank, you know. And to this day, I don't know where my other siblings were. I guess I must have been the troubled kid that couldn't be left home alone. I don't know. My dad and my mom split up when I was little. And, you know, once again, being a little kid, looking at stuff, trying to figure out what was going on in an immature brain. And, you know, somewhere I learned to come to the thought that the only one I could trust is me, you know, and, you know, going inside here, you know, and I felt safe. And so, you know, when you put booze with that kind of thinking, it's going to be a wreck. I don't know when I had my first drink. I remember stealing that can of Schaefer when I was about 7. My Aunt Bernice, which was my mom's sister, had a picnic. And, you know, I always knew the alcohol, you know, the different colored bottles behind the bar. I associated alcohol with fun. Even though my mom was violent and nasty, I sort of overlooked that part of the alcohol, you know. And but I remember getting that can of Schaefer that one summer. I was about 7. And the hardest thing was to get back to open up that can with the church key without the adults missing it. But I remember that feeling of euphoria, running around with the other kids, having fun. It seemed like the sun was up forever. And that was my goal. Now, I've heard a lot of people talk about their experiences with alcohol. You know, the first time they drank, they never had that feeling again. That's not my story. I always got that feeling. I may have paid more of a price to continue drinking, but I always got where I was looking to go. Always, always. You know, I probably really started drinking maybe when I was about 12. It seems to be the magic number in AA, you know. My sister Joyce was a pretty crazy drunk. She was maybe 16 when I was 12. So, you know, the focus was on her. My mom got married again. My mom was a serial marrier, you know. She'd always find another drunk, and you get two drunks together trying to raise four kids. It's crazy, you know. And I don't blame that guy for trying. And they weren't his kids. So whenever he tried to tell us what to do, you know, what we said, you ain't my dad. So there was, you know, there was inherited trouble. Growing up in the city, getting alcohol was pretty easy. Getting money was pretty easy. We all worked. Paper routes, you know, cutting grass in the neighborhood, hustling money. But you know what? If I look back, 12, 13 years old, if I couldn't get money and we were trying to get money together to drink, I would go knock on one of my customers' doors on a Monday or a Tuesday and tell them that I wasn't going to be around the end of the week to collect the paper route money. Could you give it to me now just so I can drink? So I was already lying, cheating, conniving, and stealing. And you know where that goes? It just continues, you know? But in my head, I always made allowances for my stupid. You know, I was a Boy Scout. You know, I did the normal things that normal kids did. Walking downtown Perth Amboy, they had five corners, big intersection, and that's, you know, the cops used to stand on the street corners. I'm in my Boy Scout uniform, smoking a cigarette, ain't bothering anybody, you know? And that cop sort of grabbed me by the throat, and he took that cigarette and he smacked it out of my mouth, and he said I was a disgrace to my uniform. And I'm looking down at my Boy Scout uniform going, what are you talking about? And the reason why I bring that up is it seemed like I lived in two worlds. You know, they talk about that Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde in the Big Book. I didn't get there yet, but, you know, the Boy Scout guy is not supposed to be smoking cigarettes and smoking joints and drinking beers. It's just, you're supposed to be crossing old ladies, I guess, across the road. I was confused, you know what I mean? I did what I wanted to do, and it seemed like when the authority would call me out on it, I took issue with it. You know, it seemed like I always had conflict, and I got pissed off about it. I would say my saving grace was I kept my mouth shut. Don't ask me why, but I did. So there I am, going through those teenage years, you know. I did other things. I started with alcohol. I ended with alcohol. I did other dry goods. Growing up as a kid, I heard in our home, and if you did this, it doesn't mean I'm better or smarter. I heard as long as you don't stick anything in your arm, you're not that bad. And but for the grace of God, I didn't do that. And the guys that were doing that used to tell me, you ain't going to do this because you're going to like this too much. And but for the grace of God, I did not do that. That's my not yet, you know. But for me, the drinking, the lying, the stealing, don't ask me how I never got arrested. The cops were always pulling me over. I guess there was always somebody doing something worse, you know. And I'm just going through life, you know, drinking, partying. I didn't realize that I was homeless when I was 15. My mom moved and, you know, I stayed in the house until they sold it. And when the people bought it, they said, you can't come in here. And so I guess I must be a survivor because I couldn't really tell you what I did. I remember sleeping in cars. Young kid years ago talked about couch surfing. I guess I was a surfer. I guess people felt sorry for me and they let me stay until it was time to go. You know, I traveled light. I guess, you know. I always worked though. I always had a job because I guess I had a guy, he was a good friend of mine. He's been in jail since like 1975, you know, and I just turned 64 in October. Michael turned 64 in September. He's still in jail. He got out maybe once or twice, you know. He didn't have a program, so it was a short time he was back. So I kind of know AA for me gave me a direction, which I never followed, right? But I look at that guy, 10, 20, 30-year bids and getting out, you know, doing life, you know. That's such a sad thing, but I guess, what, you know, I stopped doing things that were going to put me in prison to the point of it's easier to work, get an honest day's pay, you know? And I always had pretty good jobs. You know, growing up in Perth Amboy, when the bars closed at Amboy during the week at 2 a.m., we all went to Staten Island. The bars in Staten Island were open till 4 a.m. And at 4 a.m., they'd say, hey, you can order a bunch of beers. And, you know, they would reopen at 5 where you can go to work. And that was my, you know, should I stay or should I go thing. And, you know, in your 20s, sleeping for a couple hours and giving a good day's work was pretty easy, you know. I used to think the Outer Bridge was so wide, and it's really not, you know. It was all the junks coming across, and I don't know why. I was truly blessed. I never got pulled over. And I don't think too many people did. I guess they just let us do our thing, you know. Those were the 70s and the 80s. First time I had a look at my drinking, and it's the only time I'll ever mention drugs in AA, but it was a pretty big event. So it's the late 70s, the bars in Amboy, you know, we're all watching our Hollywood Saturday Night Live people that came on 11:30, you know, all our idols, and Tumanols were going around the streets of Perth Amboy at that time, and I'm drinking my, you know, my Heineken's, having a good old time. And I remember, I was a little guy, I was 115 pounds with a ponytail, and I took 3 Tumanols after drinking all night, and we went to a bar on the other side of town. And if you've ever been in a bar where they lock the door and they close the bar and you're on the inside and they pull those little strings on the neon signs to let everybody on the outside know this bar is closed and you're on the inside, that's like being locked in heaven. And at least it was for me. And I remember to go in the back to play pool. I have no idea what happened, and I still don't. I woke up the next day, I had an apartment, and I remember having a really bad headache. The pillowcase was covered with blood, and I do not know what happened. Now, prior to this, having blackouts and grayouts meant I had a good time, you know, but winding up in the hospital, you know, this was one of my first opportunities where I went to tell the truth, right? I end up getting a dozen stitches in the back of my head, and the nurse asked what happened, and I said, I don't remember. She called me a liar, and I was thoroughly convinced this is why you don't tell the truth. Just make up a story. It's easier. But then you got to remember the story. But what that did for me was, my birthday was right around the corner. I was going to be 20, and I was 10 years or so of some really good drinking and abusing myself. So I stopped drinking, I stopped drugging, I quit smoking, I cut my ponytail, and I moved out of Perth Amboy. And honestly, my life got better. Not realizing I changed people, places, and things, right? I think my sister was sober already. Joyce got sober in 79. So she might have just got sober. And but you see, for me, I just took a break. I really didn't have a program. I was way too young in my head, you know. And if I can backtrack for a second, growing up in a crazy alcoholic home for me only made what I thought about the world wrong. I didn't know there was a life to live that was worth. I didn't know. I'm not blaming my parents, but you know, I just never got to that chapter in the book. You know, I thought I was just going to be dead at 30, and I'm okay with that, you know? And so almost a year later, I was at a picnic, big picnic, over there by Girls Vocational School over in Warren Park. And then people down there, way down there at the bottom of the hill, hanging out at that beer truck, it seemed like when they laughed, their laughter sounded way better than the people I was hanging out with. And I didn't realize that I had missed my lover. And my ex-wife, now girlfriend, then she said, go. Because nobody ever told me not to. It was just something. And actually, there was a girl that was at our meeting last week talking about marking the calendar. Or was that the week before? I was marking the calendar when I stopped drinking. who marks the calendar when you stop? You know? But anyway, from that point until my last drink was August 20th, 1987. And that wasn't the day I decided to be a saint. That was just done. But what happened from when I started to that point, I think it's, as Bill sees it, the 10th step. Nothing much grows in the dark. You know, in the big book, it says I'm supposed to share in a general way what it was like and what happened. I don't go into details. You know, the horror of the things I've done, I cannot blame on alcohol. See, I used to blame alcohol for my behavior, but that's not fair to alcohol. I was still doing what I was doing. You know, I'm running the streets. So I used to say when, I don't know about Pennsylvania, I think you guys still got newspapers. We ain't got no more papers in Jersey. But they used to have the police blotter, and they would put what happened in your community. And everything that was bad usually happened about 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and 4 a.m. Most normal people are home sleeping. Not me, man. That's where all the fun is at, you know? The cops, the running, the chaos. And I'm in the mix. I get married in 1984. Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I want this married life. I want this good life. But I want to have fun. And I want to, you know, do stuff. I remember my wife used to tell me, why don't you stay home and drink? And I looked at her and said, ain't no fun here. What a terrible thing to say to somebody that you marry. Can you imagine? She's here. You know, I used to steal her money from her pocketbook. And there were no ATMs, right? Yeah, that's true, but I'm stealing money. Can you imagine not being safe? You're not even safe in your own home. And I had a sponsor way back, Frank, passed away, sober. If you never look at what you do, you'll always do what you always did. I got to look at the patterns of what I do. Why do I do what I do? I used to steal my mom's money. I used to steal my mom's cigarettes. So to me, that was normal. That's nowhere near normal, but it was normal to me, you know? So Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you know, I married this girl. I was attracted to this way of life. And I don't know. You know, people say took a hostage. I didn't take a hostage. She was a willing participant too. You know, she didn't drink. Her father was a drunk. There's patterns. I work in the fire department. So I'm a fireman, and when the cops pull me over at 2-3 in the morning, you know what I tell them, right? I don't curse at meetings, but you can fill in the blanks. I was arrogant. And I used to say stupid stuff. They used to tell me, why don't you just go kill yourself in somebody else's town? And I'd tell them, have a good night. And, you know, not just was I a fireman, my father-in-law was police chief in that town. My sister-in-law was a cop in that town. And if anybody would have got me, it would have been her, I could tell you. And I was just, I didn't think anybody knew what I was doing. You know, they say, right, Alcoholics Anonymous? Nah, alcoholics obvious, you know? I was, when you're driving at 2, 3, 4 in the morning and they know you and you're coming, you know, suiting up, supposedly, and showing up for work, it was obvious, you know? And I'm just going through this crazy life thinking nobody knows what I'm doing. I'm just going to have a good time. Just want to have a couple of drinks, do some of this, do some of that, and I'll go home. And I never went home. And sun would come up and the sun would go down. You know, when my son was born, July the 8th, 1985, I was blessed to be at the hospital when he was born to see the miracle of a birth. My arrogance said, women have babies, what's the hassle? That's arrogance. My son was healthy, thank God. And they kept my wife in the hospital for 4 days, and she came home and had no money because John was having a good time. And I was probably 2 miles from the hospital, having parties at the house, you know, doing stupid things. And this is what I do. And I don't even think twice about it. And if somebody questioned me, I'll tell you where to go. It was all about me. It's so sad. It really is. And but one of the things that I can tell you that as a a little guy, I made a promise to myself. I was not going to do to my kids what was done to me. And my son was healthy. He came home. And for the next couple of years of his life, I was doing to him what was done to me, you know? And I don't know. They say you can't get sober for nobody but you. That shame and guilt or remorse or that thought, I could never get out of my head. I couldn't drink it away. Because when you look at the man in the mirror, there it is. And it just, I was torn. I couldn't get wasted and be totally free of my brain to be wasted anymore. So I came to AA the first time in actually 1985. My wife at the time worked with a guy that got sober in the 40s. He took me to my first meeting. It was a Monday night in Metuchen, 9 o'clock, open speaker meeting, and all of them people hanging out front were laughing, and laughter is music of the soul. For me, laughter was pain. If Bobby didn't hold my little hand like a little kid and take me through the crowd, I would have turned around and went the other way. That's just what I would have done. And I wasn't afraid of dying. I'm hanging out with outlaw bikers. Nothing like hanging out with rapists and murderers and jail guys to just have a little excitement in your drunken days. But that's just where I was at, you know. And I was a little better because I wasn't that bad yet. I came to AA probably for 3 months. The second meeting I went to was Perth Amboy Tuesday night. That meeting started May of 1945, and it still meets at the same place every Tuesday. How cool was that? You know, and I knew I wasn't done. And, you know, even though I probably went 3 months without drinking, I knew I wasn't done. Because I couldn't drive around the town without passing a bar, without feeling that energy of that bar pulling me in. So when people tell me they're driving down the road, and man, they turned into the, yeah, I believe you. Because that happened. I couldn't get home without passing a bar and missing all of that excitement. You know, they say that the register has to ring zero. I have to be at the jumping off place. I have to be beat so stupid that I had no more fight and no more answers to the questions I didn't even know. But I had no more game plan. I had nothing. And that's what wound up happening to me. I was on a 3-day run. You know, the jig was up. People at work knew John's AWOL. And the only thing that saved me was I had a good long work history with them. And they knew I was a good worker. Alky's usually hard workers, you know. And we got to work twice as hard when you got a hangover and you haven't slept. That's just what I say. So they knew what to do with me, right? They wanted to send me to, I asked for help. They were going to let me go, but I ain't stupid. I knew I was going to do this. They had no clue how many times guys were covering me, you know? And so I went to the Nut House for my drinking. And that was just the beginning, you know? When I got out of the Nut House, you know, the only thing I could truly take credit for is not listening to me. Because I could take credit for putting myself, getting myself locked up in a nut house. Everything after that, I give credit to AA. 99% of the stuff that I'm saying, I heard right here in AA. You know, the big book, you know, the people, the old timers, their kindness. They gave me the key to the church to make coffee. And I'm the guy stealing my wife's pocketbook. And she was a good Catholic girl that drove her nuts. They gave you the key? How could that be? And then if you read chapter 9, I'm listening to people I'm just meeting, and they're the ones for years and maybe even decades doing everything to get a bum like me sober, and it don't work. You know what I mean? The suggestions that they gave me, I took, mostly. And the ones I didn't, I paid the price. I heard in AA, if you do the right thing's going to happen. No, that's silly. If I don't drink, I won't get drunk. You know what's going to happen? Life. But what I did do is I chose to pay attention to people that had cancer, lost their house, lost a loved one. You know, really things that were, I thought in my young brain, reasons to drink. And they didn't drink. And that blew me away. So I'd watch. And they're happy. I'm going, how? I don't get it. So as we're reading stuff and going to meetings and hearing people talk, you know, they said the only thing between me and a drink is a higher power, and I didn't have one. You want to gauge somebody's sobriety, go home and talk to their spouse. Uh-oh. You know, I'm in trouble. If you would ask me, I never abused a woman. My mom was beat a lot by her second husband. I would never do that. But I found out there's other kinds of abuse. When I ain't coming home for 3 days, and my then wife used to say, I wish you would have died, because I could have got over that. What do you mean? You know, there's all kinds of abuse. You know, I used to pat myself on the back for being a good guy. That was only in my head. That wasn't true. So I'm going through this AA stuff, you know, just like everybody else, early sobriety. I think you're new till you get 5 years. 5 years is 90 days, looking back. You would ask me when I had 5 years. I said, I got 5 years. You know, I continue to learn as much today as I did then. It blows my mind. I would have thought clearly by now I would have some insight. And it's just a continuing learning. We had a baby that was born. Sober baby. I'm going to do this one right. And my daughter was born December 28th, 1995. And I got the coffee, the newspaper, and the camera strolling into the hospital. I've been down this road before. And so my daughter was born at 7:05, and she didn't start breathing until 7:25. And I'm saying, this ain't happening. Can't be happening. I'm sober. And I swear when I'm telling you, I have this out-of-body experience, and I'm thinking what happened to me now, looking back, I basically, you know, you go into shock, kind of, sort of, and everything slows down, you know? And so they're asking me, or they're telling me, or giving me a suggestion, I don't remember, about sending her up to Newark, to Beth Israel. And my wife at the time is laying there. I'm like, let's wake her up and ask her, you know? And now my daughter went up there. And if you were around the East Coast at those years, 95, 96, we had a little bit of snow, the most snow we ever had. And I'm going into Newark. You don't want to go to Newark, you know? And my daughter was there for almost 3 months. 2 weeks after Gabby was born, I found my father dead on the floor. And it was the most comfortable in my skin I ever was. I finally understood it. My higher power didn't prevent any of this from happening. He just gave me the strength to go through it. Life happens to everybody, you know? Had some regrets with, literally, as soon as I found my father, the coulda, woulda, shoulda stuff that you go through, you know? Whatever. But the people in AA were definitely a support. But I had already had a foundation of a higher power that got me through it. I was reading the Prayer of St. Francis for years. And when we stuck my dad in the ground, that was what the Franciscan friars read. And you know, I mean, it was truly the most comfortable I ever was in my skin. And, you know, honestly, that feeling is what I was trying to get with alcohol all those years, where no matter what's happening, you're good. And it was a false thing with booze because I always overshot it. You know, people say in AA, because I would listen and stuff sounded good, so it must be right. I'm addicted to more. Wait a minute. When I was self-centered and everything was about me. I wanted more to fill me. But today, I'm still addicted to more. More meetings, more love, more kindness, more service. And we took a nice ride out here, coming from Jersey. I mean, if I was drinking and you told me you were having a cake party, I would, why are we waiting until next week? Let's have it now. You know, but it's different. It's for recovery now. You know, the things that happened in life, I didn't think that my marriage was going to fall apart. And you know, when my daughter was in that hospital, one of the doctors grabbed me on the side and he said, "Hey, bud, I got to talk to you." He said, "I'm going to tell you, this is the end of your marriage." So how do you say that? I understood what he was trying to tell me. When you have a severely handicapped child, it's either going to pull you apart or rip you up. You know, we both worked, so we didn't get any help. You know what I mean? It was after my daughter came home, that was it. And the wonderful blessing for me about being a fireman was my schedule was one day on, 3 days off, so I was Mr. Mom. And I shouldn't even have been a fireman because the day I got hired, I'm dirty. I'm not thinking they're going to give a urine test the next day. You know, but somehow we got around that. And you know, when I look back and thinking people were picking on me and I got a bad break and things didn't go my way, they were all going my way. But because I was self-centered, I didn't see it. And when it's all about me, I'm always getting the short end of the stick. That's not true. That's not true. You know, my daughter is 28 years old. She can't talk. She's on a feeding tube. She's a quadriplegic. And probably if you talk to me after the meeting, I'll show you thousands of pictures of my daughter smiling, you know. And guys that I sponsor, when they complain about their luxury problems, I say, "Hey, man, can you scratch your nose?" Because my daughter can't, you know. And it's not the demeanor where they're coming from, but it's in reality is it's not that bad. I got luxury problems, you know. So the marriage ended up, and you know, one of the things that I can tell you, my experience, I didn't tell nobody what to do, but let's go back when I made that promise to myself, I'm not leaving my kids. I stayed in a bad marriage for years, and I'm not blaming my ex-wife for anything. I stayed in a bad marriage because I was not going to leave my kids. And when you're ready to shoot yourself in the head sober, it's time to go. You know what I mean? And the way I looked at it was, I got to back up a little bit, retreat, and, you know, make this better. And so I live out here in Holland Township. My daughter comes out Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or whatever. And Diane and I take care of my daughter. And my ex gets a break, and my daughter's with her there. And see, this all worked out well. But at the time, it's like, this isn't what I planned on. This, you know, the sober life, this wasn't supposed to happen. No, it happened. You know, that job that I didn't respect, I learned to respect. I retired 14 years already. It's a good life not to have to work. Work is way overrated, you know. I don't even know where I can find the time to work anyway, because I'm busy. You know, that's the wonderful thing about being sober is, work moves out of the way and all of a sudden life fills in, you know. But one of the things I never really talk about whenever I'm speaking, and we got a little bit, the old timer said to me and other people, don't tell us about what you do, show us. So I went from doing the coffee to doing the chairs. The home group is the most important group. That's where everybody gets to come and be my guest. And I'm supposed to make sure the coffee's there, the lights are on, and all of that stuff, you know? And but because of service, I had opportunities to do all kinds of things, you know? Last month was the first time, I've had a detox commitment for 36 years. Last month was the first time in 36 years I missed my commitment. And I only missed it because I had COVID. And I wasn't going to go get anybody sick, you know. And I thought to myself, that was a pretty good run, you know. When they talk about being selfish, I do these commitments for me. I'm selfish. I want to do the detox commitment. I don't want to forget. Now, I've done the prison commitments for a long time. I don't want to forget. You know, to me, I believe, and I got to tell you, because now it just popped into my brain. You know, family's number one. Family, 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 family. You know, when they say you can't say no to AA, if I have a commitment with my daughter and you're asking me to make coffee after I made a commitment to take care of my daughter, I'm not blowing her off. I can't make your coffee. And the young man that asked me to read tonight, now you know why I didn't take it, right? But you can say no if it's going to interrupt doing something like a previous commitment, right? Family. I go on a lot of retreats. That's one of the things that really truly saved me. Up until maybe this last year, I probably went on 5 retreats a year for the last, I don't know, since January 1st, 1989. You know, it's interesting because I went on my first retreat, some guy was talking about a bunch of men get together for a weekend. No girls? Just men. Yeah. Why do I want to do that? Well, it's like a men's meeting for the weekend. And it's at this retreat house down the shore. And they got priests and nuns. Now the nuns, and they threw me out of second grade, out of school in second grade. Now I'm going to go back. This was in my head. This isn't fitting. And I go down there on a Friday. I had a secret handshake, and they were booked. They had probably 20, 30 guys on a waiting list. And I didn't feel comfortable. I was jonesing out. You know, alcohol was that sober lubricant when I did something new, take that edge off, you know, that fear. And I want to leave. I'm going. I ain't staying here. This sucks. I'm leaving. But I had that battle in my head. I'm saying, I'm leaving to go where? With me outside? So I stayed, and I was the last guy to leave on Sunday, and I've been going ever since. I truly believe we get these battles in our head with ourselves. You know, I don't know, the ego's telling me to heck with this, and all of that nonsense, all that itty-bitty committee in the brain. And so I stayed, and it, you know, they talk about fear and the boogeyman, you know what I mean? I pushed through it. I wasn't comfortable doing it, but I did it. And I was thankful. I had a conversion that weekend within myself. And it's funny because when Diane and I were coming here, I got a little discombobulated and pulled up to a guy, and somebody in the car in front of us asked how to get here. And what'd she say? Do I need faith? I said, I'm looking for this church. He goes, do you need faith? And I'm like, amen. The biker looking for the, yeah, here I come. Whatever, I had fun with it. It was cool. Peace. I love having fun. It talks about us not being a glum lot. I'm not a glum lot. I love having fun. You know, I didn't think that I was going to be living in Hunterdon County. I didn't think I was not going to be married. I was one of those guys that was married for life. Death do us part, and I'm wishing for death. That's not good. You know, I was with this guy, Crazy Charlie, and we took a ride to a meeting I'd never been to, and I ended up being an H-step meeting. I was sober 25 years, and I had this sense that I need to go and make amends to my ex-wife. And I know I had done it before, but this was different. And I go to her house, I believe it might have been the next day, and I said, hey, Michelle, I need to talk to you. I says, you know, the way I treated you when I drank, if I remember or don't remember, whatever I did, if I can make it right, just tell me. And I shut up. And she went on and on and on. And I'm thinking, damn shame you didn't go to Al-Anon. But that was my ego. The truth of the matter was, I owned what I did. And I got away with not hearing about it for 25 years. You know, I believe that they say there's two sins. The first sin is if I get in the way of my growth. And the second sin is if I get in the way of your growth. And I believe the second sin is worse. Because they don't have the free will to be smart enough to run from me when I'm drinking. And to hurt another human being emotionally, spiritually, is not good. You know, I thought as long as I didn't hit nobody, I'm not doing any harm. 25 years later, this woman went on like it just happened. It was real to her. And I thought, my God. So, I'm not a doormat, but I continue to suit up and show up. If I can do something to right a wrong, then I'm going to do it. You know, when I left that house and I paid the mortgage in that house, and my ex made more than I did, but my kids lived there. And after a couple years, you know, I got on my feet. Diane and I had a house that I was renting a block from a house that I owned. And my daughter didn't want to leave her house. And I used to get her between the two houses, which was like a block apart. I said, Gab, look, my house, your house. You're going to spend the night, right? She said, yeah. I take her to my house, and there it is, 2:00 in the morning. I'm pushing her up the street in a wheelchair because she wanted to go home. But the thing was, if you know, the alcoholic, if he doesn't make it about him, it's not that bad. I had to take her home. That's where she wanted to go. She doesn't do that to me anymore, thank God. But it was, you know, they talk about anger being this dubious luxury that better off left to people that can handle it. Doesn't mean I'm not going to get angry. But what am I going to do? I got to try to pray, and I got to get rid of it. I got to let it go because, and you know, it's 7:47. I'm going to tell you because, you know, I'm telling you some good things that you think John's a good guy, right? So I was sober 9 years. My daughter was a year old. My daughter screamed and cried 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for about 5 years. I thought more of suicide than I ever did when I drank. So I took a day off from work because that was the only day we got a nurse, on the day I had to go to the firehouse. And so I took a day off so I could hop on the scooter and take a ride. I get 2 blocks from my house. I got cut off by a car. And they gave me the Jersey salute. And I went, you know, when they talk about people having blackout rage, I had one of those at that moment. And I acted in not sober. And I almost got jammed up. This woman was jumping out of her car with the thing running. And it was right in front of City Hall, actually, where I work. Go figure. And but some lady was yelling, coming from down the street yelling, saying, Mister, I'm sorry. That's my daughter. And I taught her better than that. It was a funeral procession. Blackout rage anger almost put me in a position, and they talk about that in our literature, right? That anger is going to take me to a place and tie me to so many other things that have nothing to do with the original problem. Now, I can read stuff and be pretty smart, but it doesn't really mean anything to me until I have an experience with it. And then I was sober 9 years. I have never done that again. Because I feel standing in front of a judge, and he finds out, he says, Mr. Bodnar, you're sober all these years, and that was your best thinking? Hey, listen, I'm not a saint. All the saints are dead. You know what I mean? But to me, you know, I never realized how many times Bill Wilson says a word in his writings, and you may think it's God. It's not. He says, try. Just try not to drink. Just try to act a little better. Just try not to get angry. Just try to help somebody. You know what I mean? Because if I'm going to at least try, I'm going to be a part of the positive side of it, you know? And that son of mine, Garrett, he was 2 years old when I got sober. He's going to be 39, and he turned out to be not a nice guy. And it breaks my heart because I thought I equated being a sober dad and having a sober home fitting. And it does, or maybe not. You know, I can only try to do my best and be the best sober dad, and whatever happens, happens. You know, they say the most powerful thing I could do is pray. I do a lot of praying because then I feel like I'm doing something and I'm not in the mix. You know, I'm careful not to pray and tell God what I think he needs to do, because then I'm still letting my ego be a part of it. And, you know, just recently, Diane and I, we have a guy that was a member of our home group 12 years, did everything. And somehow he copped an attitude and he left. And somebody was asking about him recently and he's like, what happened to him? And I think it's something that could happen to me or anybody else. And it goes like this. My ego could be so right and it could get me in a hole that my pride will not let me get out and I'm going to die. And then there you go. Once again, one of Bill's writings. What does he say? The pride goes before the fall. I got to be careful. You know, so when I started this saying, I'm doing just as much inventory and prayer. You know, that template that I learned in that nut house of getting on my knees in the morning and doing that final 10 step at night, I do that every day. Because I know on the once or twice that I don't, I have a rotten day and I'm blaming you for it. And I have to keep the focus on me. You know, that nothing much grows in the dark. You know, continue that 10 step, continue to take inventory. You know, it may only take a couple seconds throughout the day. It's just like when you're old and you're driving and you're looking through your mirrors, you do it like you're not even realizing you're doing it. That's kind of what this whole template of AA is for me. And here's the deal. I'm out of gas. And it's 751. So I think it's close enough. What do you guys think? So I'm going to bring Michael back up to close. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, thank you, thank you.